Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. Monday through Wednesday of this past week, we were having a WAMC fund drive, and we're so grateful that so many people donated so we could have a roundtable panel on Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, June 8th, Joe Donahue was joined by investigative journalist and RPI in New Albany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
Noxious air spreads across the U.S. Conditions are expected to get better, but driven by wildfires in Canada, the smoke over the Northeast is spreading, with alerts extended to the Midwest and the Carolinas. As of right now, Washington, D.C., the air quality is hazardous. In New York City, it is very unhealthy. It is moderately bad in Chicago and Boston. The level of pollution Wednesday was higher than the worst day in San Francisco after major wildfires in 2018 in New York yesterday. This is obviously a big problem. And I mean, quite frankly, right now, as we sit in this room, all you smell is smoke. You think, wow. And it's and my brother, I was talking to my brother who lives in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and they have it too. It's really stunning when you think about it. Rosemary?
Well, I think that what we're seeing, of course, is a portent of the future. There will be more fires, not fewer, more dryness, more bizarre weather because it's climate change, which we continue to bury our head in the sand. There's going to be a lot more sand in which to bury our heads in the future as this continues. And I find that very, very sad. I also think it's a height of hypocrisy, and Joy Reid pointed this out last night. I don't usually quote her, but she pointed out that we're seeing the PGA right now support one of the major distributors of fossil fuel, which contributes to climate change, which contributes to these fires, which makes it difficult for us to breathe. And we don't see the connection between the money that a small group will get and the air we breathe.
Mike?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And you know, even in the state of Texas, there's an effort to – they are actually one of the most sustainable states because
right.
of the enormous amount of windmill energy that they have produced. And yet they're backing away from that, and they're passing rules in their power grid, and they're passing laws that promote gas and promote oil. And it's political, and it just seems this is the time when we should be stepping up our movement away from fossil fuels, because now we see a tangible result of that folly.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be a long, smoky summer because the Canadian wildfire season has started much earlier than normal. It's much more intense than normal. There are far more fires than typical, and usually it starts much later in the summer. You know, from a local perspective, you know, we waited all winter to be able to go outside and, you know, have a picnic or go for a walk. And now we're all stuck inside because of the smoke, because it's just dangerous to be out there. But we need to recognize that the reason that we're having this problem is because of climate change. It's too hot, it's mm-hmm. windy, it's dry, and that is encouraging these wildfires to roar in Canada, and they're going to be roar here in the U.S.
It is amazing that this has been going on now for some years in our West, and we just read the stories, oh, tish, 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 but it really feels different when that smoky smell is in the air right around us and the skies are blacked out.
And when it happens in the most populous metro area
right.
in the country, so many millions of people are affected by it. And it maybe it's the wake-up call we need to just see what needs to be done and to just stop, wishing it away and just trying to believe the non-believers and really accept that we can do something about this if we try.
Do you think it'll make a difference?
I'm optimistic that it will make some difference. I don't think it'll be a flip of a switch by no means. But I think for people on the fence, this has certainly been a convincing and devastatingly convincing experience that should make them aware that we are we're heading towards disaster unless we take really quick action.
Yeah, this hasn't been just one day. This is we're on our third or fourth day of this, and it doesn't look like any clearings in sight. High school athletic events at the end of the school are being canceled. You know, kids can't go outside to play. Yankees baseball games are being canceled at LaGuardia.
Phillies Bank games are being canceled.
My grandchildren in New York City school was canceled today. You know, because they don't want them out. It's not safe.
LaGuardia had a ground stop today. They weren't sending flights out.
Wow. The photos, and I'm sure everyone has seen the photos of the skyline of Manhattan, where 24, you know, or 48-hour difference, where it's a crystal clear skyline, and you can hardly make out the buildings, the World Trade Tower, et cetera.
Looks like China.
Your former newspaper put up a picture of this was online last night. A picture of the New York skyline and the Albany skyline, and both just inundated.
Yeah.
You know, it was really very. Very stark to see those images. We go to this letter. Does anyone have any information about how this smoke is affecting local agriculture? Any idea on that, Judy Patrick or Rosemary Mayo?
Judy Patrick was the one who was asked because today in Greenwich, it's take your tractor to school day.
Drive your tractor to school day, I think. I passed five tractors heading in that direction with young people aboard. And typically at the end of the school year in Greenwich, which is a agricultural community, the kids for years have taken one day to drive their tractor to school. And it's a wonderful illustration of the fact that farming is still alive and doing okay in that neck of the woods. So
small farming too, right?
Small farming.
Medium size.
There were some pretty big tractors, I guess, this morning though. Pretty big tractors. But you know, my daughter who is in Rochester. She was calling her cat inside yesterday because she was concerned about her cat's breathing. And you know, we're all gardeners too. We're worried about how our crops are going to, how my tomato plants are going to fare. We just want some sunshine or some blue skies.
It's bad enough they didn't have rain. Now there's no rain or sunshine.
Right,
so.
But yeah, I do worry about the animals, especially the cats and dogs. Yeah. A lot of them are inside.
Cattle too. A lot of stress for cattle.
We have a lot of breathing to do.
That's right. Well, hopefully we all have a lot of breathing to do. Let's see. Susan writes, so glad to have you back. I'm glad folks are making a connection between climate change and these wildfires. Astoundingly, the New York State Legislature has yet to vote on the Packaging Reduction Act that Judith Hanks Group and other like-minded groups have been advocating for, which would reduce plastics, which are an important contributor to climate change. One thing that is in our power to do is to call the leadership in the Senate and Assembly, so an issue there. Let's see. Irene asks about, is this having an effect on the birds? Are there fewer? It seems like there's fewer birds.
No, they got to fly through that haze. It's true. All that fine particulate matter will fall to the ground, to the air, to the water at some point affect the environment that way. You know, just last week, I read a story about how you can buy an N95 mask really cheap now because the demand for them had fallen precipitously, and that you could buy like 100 for $2.
Well, the governor's giving them away for free now.
Yeah, now people are actually scrambling to get their N95s out of the closet and put them back on.
Yeah, I was wearing mine today just when I was outside, and I think it helps. Yeah,
absolutely. Lily says, tractors in Greenwich. Yes, but many kids are sick today in Greenwich because of the air, and parents are picking them up.
The tractors you have to ride. Some of them have cabs, some of them don't. I saw a few older tractors without cabs. Minutia from Greenwich.
I'll take.
You could even drive your
minutia.
Lawn tractor, apparently, and be.
Well, you used to see that a lot. There were a couple of people that, you know, had DWIs and so forth, and you'd see them. They would regularly drive their lawn tractors to Stewart's to pick up a 12-pack.
Yep.
That's so colorful, these old farming communities in upstate.
How quaint.
So cute.
It is.
Yeah, they're hard to pass the road when you want to go someplace. Lawn tractors don't go that fast.
Well, it is something that you think about. Susan writes, do you hear your own cognitive dissonance? And unless the tractors are electric, it is terrible for the climate to use them as transportation for driving children to school. Well, we're not.
They're not doing it every day. It's a symbolic thing. Come on. We blow up fireworks once a year to celebrate national independence. That's not really a great thing for dogs or the environment either. Should we stop eating ice cream altogether, too? Take all the joy out of life.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Yeah, Rosemary, thank you.
But the threshold for that joy extends all the way to golf for some people.
Oh, I so want to talk about that story. Can we commandeer the panel?
Yeah, we can okay. Pivot if you want. I never really thought that anyone on our panel would say, let's talk about the golf story. But this really is an interesting story that the PGA and LIV, L-I-V, golf deal has been done. These two major powerhouses in golf are merging. The PGA Tour, is the world's preeminent professional golf league, and LIV Golf, a Saudi-funded upstart whose emergence over the past year and a half has cleave the sports in two, have agreed to join forces. The pact is complicated, it is incomplete, and numerous golfers hate it. They are directing their wrath at the architects of the deal. So one of the things about this that I think is most interesting is that it came really from left field. Nobody thought it was in the works. Nobody thought it was coming. And it surprised a lot of people that these talks were either underway. The PGA Tour holds tournaments nearly every weekend, mostly in the United States, but also in other countries in North America, Europe, and Asia, with prize pools worth millions of dollars. The tour has been the home to practically every male golfer you can name, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Arnold Palmer, and so on. It has relationships with, but is separate from, the organizations that stage men's golf four majors, the Masters, the PGA, the U.S. Open, and the British Open. The LPGA, which runs the Women's Tour, is separate. LIV Golf began in late 2021 with former PGA player Greg Norman as its commissioner and billions of dollars in backing from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is known as the Public Investment Fund. LIV lured several PGA Tour players, including the major champions, including Phil Mickelson, with massive purses and guaranteed payouts that far surpassed what they could earn on the established PGA circuit. They promised a sharp break from golf's fusty traditionalism. That's the word the New York Times use, fusty. Starting with its name, which, when pronounced, rhymes with give.
Live,
but is actually the Roman numeral for 54, the number of holes played in each tournament. See what they
I
did
didn't
there?
Know that.
Isn't that cool? Live.
Nothing
has,
about that group I'm, is cool. No.
No. But I'm sure a PR firm
came up with
you know,
that.
Came up with that.
A well-paid PR
wealthy
firm.
Live had more music blaring at its events, looser dress codes, team competitions, and tournaments that lasted 3 days instead of four. Further and of particular appeal to potential players, while the PGA Tour tournaments cut golfers with the worst scores after two rounds, LIV did not cut anybody. Acrimonious, to put it lightly, the answer to the question, what was the relationship between the leagues before the deal to align, which makes this really... again, why it was so surprising. They announced this yesterday, the creation of a new entity that would combine their assets as well as those of the DP World Tour and radically change golf's governance. Rosemary.
Oh, yeah. I just think this is a terrible decision. It is not just about sports. And in fact, I think sports journalists are the last people on earth who should be covering the story. Look at how in-depth they went on Tiger Wood. This is a nefarious act that goes against the wishes of many of the players who are not consulted about this merger. And it aligns the PGA, which is a supposed to be a feel-good sports involvement, healthy enterprise, with a torturer, a murderer, a man who rules a country that holds down women and criminalizes being gay. It's just a terrible look. I don't understand why it was needed except for one thing, and that is money. One more reason to hate golf for those who do.
Yeah, and one more aspect of it is that LIV has been welcome to the Trump golf.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Golf courses and resorts, and it just illustrates how. I mean, I like the idea of an upstart league, kind of competing with the established league. I mean, I'm certainly, there's people who have complaints about the way the PGA operates, et cetera, and it's rather elite, but. But the Saudis coming in with their billions of dollars to back it just taints it so bad. And it just illustrates exactly what you said, Rosemary. It's all about money.
Here, let's be clear. The Saudis are just trying to whitewash or burnish their image. They're trying to make people forget about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. They're trying to make people forget about their treatment of women in the country. They want people to forget about their involvement in 9/11. I mean, there are people in America who are outraged by this.
Including the 9/11 families, and they feel betrayed by this, and indeed they have been.
Right, and the fact that it did just come out of the blue talks a little bit about the journalism that was involved in following this project, because I do think that there are some good sports journalists who do try to do some investigative work. There aren't very many of them, and this one slipped right by them.
Well, it slipped by news reporters, too. And, in fact, the Saudis, I'm sure it was that well-paid PR agency we mentioned, gave the story. It came out of the blue. It wasn't in the Washington Post or the New York Times or any of the sports publications, ESPN. It was on CNBC, which is not a very good business broadcast. And that's because plainly they want us to see this as a very good decision that will help the business of golf and not about what it is, a betrayal, a moral betrayal.
Remember the Saudis hosted the World Cup just, what was it, last year? They were, it was Qatar.
Qatar.
I mean, it was, but they are trying to get more involved in the sports that we all care about.
Well, they see that the value of the benefits of being associated with something so popular worldwide that they can just glom onto it with their billions of dollars and really, as you said, whitewash their image, which is
they're using the term all over, sports washing, which is the idea that you watch this lovely golf game in a beautiful setting, well financed, which it obviously will be now with the Saudis, and forget about holding down women, criminalizing gay activity, killing journalists, holding down transparency. It is promoting fossil fuel, even though it's destroying the earth. These are not good people. Why do we have to associate with them?
You almost feel sorry for, some of the professional golfers who said no to LIV and said, no, you can pay me as many millions of dollars as you want. I'm not going to go there.
It'll be interesting to see how they react.
Well, and I guess that's part of my question. I mean, it seems like it seems like a done deal, and yet there's a lot of aspects of the deal that aren't done. And will the outcry from players and other officials within the PGA have some impact on any changes or even torpedo it? I don't know.
That they announced this without having it all worked out is probably part of the strategy. Like, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube, but I'll bet the outcry will influence that, and maybe talks will break down. It's almost like, anything, if it isn't ironed out, and when it comes down to the fine print of everything, it may not work out, and I kind of hope it doesn't.
I hope so too, and I hope you're right. But there's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a push that, like, well, this is sports; it's different than politics. Many people think that.
Remember the South African rugby team, the Springboks, would go around the world, and people were protesting it. They even came here to Albany back in 1981, I think, or 80, and they, you know. Many in the world said, we need to boycott South Africa in every way, you know, culturally and economically, and that includes sports also. And others said, no, sports is different. Sports it transcends. Different. We don't want it to get in the way. And I understand that, but this is exactly weaponizing sports to use it to promote really vile, repugnant positions.
Yeah. And the idea that sports is above it all, like the Olympics, for example, that's a fallacy. Mm-hmm. And please let us recognize this. I think that statements from the PGA officials yesterday were, again, tailored by a public relations firm. Like, yes, we sympathize with the families of 9/11. Saudi Arabia engineered that. Engineered the attack on the United States. We didn't speak or speak about Japanese people in less than derogatory terms for 50 years, yet we're going to play golf with the Saudis. And at the same time that we feel for them, we are, after all, allies with the Saudi Arabians.
And let's not forget it's about a little bit about the oil as well.
Oh,
and as we deal with the haze outside our this office here, we have to recognize that everything is interrelated.
And they just announced this week that the Saudis on their own was going to restrict the output of barrels of crude oil to raise the price. So that's going to hit us.
Great allies. Yeah. Let's play golf with them. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah.
Rosemary Armeo and Mike Spain on the roundtable panel on Thursday, June 8th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, or facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, June 9th, Joe Donahue was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Chair of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences and founding director of the Future of Computing Institute at RPI, Jim Hendler, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
The Justice Department on Thursday took the legally and politically momentous step of lodging federal criminal charges against former President Donald Trump, accusing him of mishandling classified documents. He kept upon leaving office and then obstructing the government's efforts to reclaim them. This from the New York Times. Mr. Trump confirmed on his social media platform that he had been indicted. The charges against him include willfully retaining national defense secrets in violation of the Espionage Act, making false statements in a conspiracy to obstruct justice, according to two people familiar with the matter. The Justice Department made no comment on the indictment Thursday and did not immediately make the document public. The former president is expected to appear in Miami in a federal district court at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. We do not know if between now and then we will learn more from the actual indictment of what it says. But just the three paragraphs I read should be enough to get us started here. David, what should we be thinking of?
Well, if you want to get a preview as to what the sealed indictment is going to look like, I would recommend to everyone to read the Washington Post coverage of this specific story, but more specifically within the story to go into the timeline of events that took place between the NARA.
The National Archives.
The National Archives and every single correspondence with
National Archives and Records Administration.
Yes, yes, sir.
Starting 2021.
Go into and read every correspondence between NARA and representatives of the Trump administration, as well as Trump as a private citizen who also had had representatives engaging with NARA on his behalf. If you read every single correspondence between those parties, you will start to flesh out what this indictment and what these indictments are going to look at. In addition to you understanding the theory of the Department of Justice's case, you will also get a preview as to who the witness is that they will intend to call to establish their case beyond a reasonable doubt. The other thing to bear in mind for your listeners is to understand that this specific case is one slice of a much larger pie, and what special the special prosecutor has done in this instance is they have taken the most clean and what I believe the easiest of all of the crimes that Mr. Trump has committed and proceeded along those lines. This is one of those cases where I know that people have questions about whether it should be tried in Washington State, Washington, D.C., or whether there's a comfort level in trying this case in Miami. And we understand the politics of those communities and the possible jury pool. This is one of those instances where the facts of this case and these indictments are so clean that it doesn't matter where you try it. You can try it, you know, in Pluto, which I understand is no longer a planet. But even if you tried it there, I think you're going to be successful in obtaining a conviction.
Successful.
Yes.
And that speaks to the strength of the case.
It speaks to the strength of the case. It speaks to, first of all, the elements of what the Department of Justice will have to establish, right? That, for example, that the withholding was willful, that he intended to actually hold on to these materials, and that he conspired to prevent them from also finding, you know, these materials, right? There is evidence abound that was, in fact, the case. And who's going to tell us that? Who's going to let us know that? It's going to be the very people that Donald Trump hired. There's not going to be one witness in this case that is... you know, aligned with the Democratic establishment, that's aligned with the current, you know, Department of Justice. Every single person who will lend their voice and lend evidence to securing a conviction in this case will be coming from the Trump administration, whether it's Pat Cipollone, who's the former counsel to the White House, or, you know, Mr. Cochran, who at one time represented Donald Trump in these proceedings.
You know, as I was sobering up in the train yesterday, I was thinking to myself,
"You got off at the right stop."
Yeah, it's the end of the line. It made it easier. I was thinking, Teresa, about it. This is also extraordinary, and it's nothing that we've heard of before. But we have a former president of the United States facing federal charges, we believe, of espionage.
Espionage, right, right, right.
I mean, I know it's just one of seven. But espionage.
Right, which is stunning. I watched Fox News last night purposefully just to, well, I guess I went back and forth, but I watched a good 2 hours of.
So you, the home listener, don't have to.
So you don't have to. And it's fascinating and troubling to me what incredible divide is. And I think this is just going to be such an incredible stress test on our democracy because you have, I mean, it seems like
You know, I wonder, is Trump running for president part of his legal strategy, right? Because it affords him all sorts of protections that he might not have otherwise.
I think he's gotten all the protection that he's going to have, because the moment he announced, the Department of Justice announced a special prosecutor. There's only one reason we have a special prosecutor, and that's because he made himself a candidate. And the appearance of impropriety of a Justice Department led by, you know, President Biden conducting an investigation in what now is a declared opponent prompted the Department of Justice to appoint a special prosecutor. I agree with you. You know, this man has tested the sturdiness of our democratic principles and values.
And structure.
Right. He's created an entire environment and culture of people who no longer have faith in institutions that I believe without him as a person in our history would never have arrived at. Right. They might have been little kernels of doubt, but I think he made it okay to just publicly doubt that. But I will say, and again, I don't think I'm wrong on this, this is not one of those cases where there's anything in question. Did you have these materials?
Right. But the messaging, and they really had some comprehensive messaging ready. And the messaging was, you know, you're criminalizing what in fact is a basic records case. This is a records case. A lot of people inadvertently mishandle these records. This is a records case, and they've criminalized it. And then the bigger message is that Joe Biden is trying to weaponize the Justice Department to take out his opponent because he can't beat him fair and square. That is a deeply troubling problem on our democracy. And in fact, there's, you know, so many layers removed, so that's not happening. And in fact, just the opposite, when Trump was president, unlike you know, prior presidents, he misused the justice or tried to misuse the Justice Department. But this saying over and over again, the Justice Department can't be trusted, the CIA can't be trusted, the IRS can't be trusted, none of these institutions, the judges, the courts, nothing can be trusted. It's this whole thing is putting an incredible strain on our process.
That's part of the Republicans'
strategy.
Strategy is to just...
But it's dangerous for democracy.
Chisel away at the legitimacy of institutions, whether that is just in terms of marshaling public opinion or actually weakening them in terms of, like, defunding the IRS, for example. To me, this is the nicest gift basket Trump could be given.
Right.
Because he runs on the politics of grievance.
Right.
He has no new policy ideas. His policy ideas were remarkable failures. The more opposition Trump faces from lawmakers, from Democratic politicians, no matter how serious the indictment is and no matter how confident, you know, prosecutors are in getting a conviction, this is going to benefit Trump. He's going to be able to say, look, they're after me.
Unless I'm interrupting you.
No, that's mainly the point. But like when you run on the politics of grievance, the more people that tell you you're doing something wrong, the more power that gives him in terms of fundraising, in terms of marshaling support of his base. And I know there's critiques of like, well, you know, enough lawsuits are going to start chiseling away his energy. Enough lawsuits are going to give voters fatigue about hearing all the bad stuff he's done. Listen, it's 2023. This has been going on since 2016. Like, all he does is get stronger and raise more money.
The question is, I think, what are the Republicans going to do? Because so far, they've just stayed silent or in a range of ways, either by making statements or by staying silent. They've enabled this behavior for years, right? But as Joe says, you know, Espionage Act, right?
Yes.
So at what point... At what point are some of them going to say enough is enough, that this goes beyond? And I don't know that they will now, but I do think, you know, you're going to have Chris Christie, who's very clear. I mean, obviously Pence just punted on this one the other day. It was just disgusting the way he was, you know, rule of law, except for this.
My apologies for interrupting you, but most of the Republicans who have spoken in the last 24 hours, 12 hours, 16
exactly.
hours,
yep.
have all said, damn that Joe Biden and his Justice Department.
Right, weaponizing. Yeah. This is not America. Now, I looked just before I came on. I hadn't seen it last night or this morning, but McConnell, I hadn't seen any statement from him yet. Has he said something yet? I've been checking and I haven't seen anything. I've been looking for some key people. Thune, McConnell, you know, some of the, you know, leadership that I think in the, you know, the cloakroom, if they're talking honestly, they don't want him around anymore, right? But is this the evidence here so strong? I mean, how can you defend the misuse of these documents that other people are jailed for years?
How
right?
can you defend the behavior of sexual predators, which they've done?
Over and over again. This is not new.
Right. And all right. it does is strengthen his base.
I was just going to say, you know, I was flipping channels last night, so I'm not sure which one I picked this up on, but somebody made the point that the name of this case is going to be United States of America versus Donald J. Trump.
Right.
And that to me just kind of sums up what you're saying, Teresa. That's kind of where we are. It's not so much Republican Democrat. It's really what our country has always stood for versus what Trump is trying to make it. And it's going to be really interesting how that plays out. Frankly, I think, you know, I know how serious these charges are. I think most people in America don't realize that obstruction and espionage and things like that, that this isn't the same as the fact that Pence had some in his garage or Biden had some in his office. It's the willfulness of it
right.
that makes it legal. But, you know, that's a subtle thing when you're just looking at the names of the charges.
We are talking about the Trump indictment. Still a lot we don't know, actually. We haven't, none of it's been officially unsealed. We don't know when that will happen, although we do know he has a court appearance on Tuesday in Miami in federal court. We have a letter from Sam who, this couldn't have come at a better time as far as, it's as if I asked him to write it. How are the documents found with Trump different than what was found with Pence and Biden? Now, this is the Trump argument, and it is also one that was addressed ad nauseum on all of the news programs last night. And I'll defer to any member of the panel who wants this. But my understanding is that having the documents and saying, having NARA come to you and say, you have this, 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 and this, and you say, oh, okay, well, here that is different than, no, I don't have it. And then they do a search warrant on your house, and then they find it, and then they ask for more stuff, and then you lie about it.
Yep. There's
Isn't that the difference?
Yeah, yeah. There's a reason why up to now there are four public theories, right, that have been made public. But by people in the know. It's the willful retention of national secrets, which is the only
one. So in English that means?
It's having top secret, like top secret information about, you know, the examples that have been public, although there's no way to confirm this until we actually have perhaps a trial or discovery, if this case makes it there. But publicly, what's been out there is nuclear secrets from the Iranians. We've got
Iran's missile program.
The Iran's missile program.
U.S. intelligence gathering efforts in China.
Yes. So those are very, very significant materials to have.
The highest.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
clearance.
This is the stuff that, you know, if you're watching a movie, it's 14 levels down, you know, under the ground where this
only
information.
See in a skiff.
Yeah. Where this information is maintained. And not the materials that were retrieved from both Pence and Joe Biden. But I think what's in the court of public opinion, of course, Donald Trump and his team are spending a ton of money in earned media, right? And spending a ton of money in publications and obtaining earned media, attempting to sway the opinion of the court of public opinion. And if you're doing that, then that's what you do. Biden did it. You know, he did it when he was a senator. He did it when and Mike Pence, you know, Mike Pence did it. He did it when he had when he was vice president, so on and so forth. But when you get to discovery and when you get to the trial and you actually see what it is that this person attempted to and conspired to deprive the government of retrieving, that's going to make people go, oh.
Let's go to Jim real quick.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, unfortunately, David, I think most of that stuff will only be released at that kind of headline level publicly. So I've held high clearances. I've been involved. I've been involved more on the nuclear side and the cyber side than some of this other stuff. But some of these documents, we're talking about things. Of the ones we've talked about, the one that really gets me is some of the things about our intelligence gathering. The one thing that you need higher and higher and higher and higher clearances to get access to is what are called sources and methods, mm-hmm. how we know what other people are doing. Because the minute they know that, if it's human, we get rid of the human. And literally people have been killed over this stuff. And if it's sources, then you start learning how to counter those sources.
Do you notice how he didn't even blink when he said we get rid of the human?
Yeah.
I was never there.
He is untethered.
You cut the tether, yeah.
No, I don't mean we. Yeah. I mean, you know, okay, so if...
Well, the person died in jail in the last week, right?
Some of these people who have released information to enemies of the United States have allowed those enemies to kill CIA agents and others. Even more importantly, kill their own people or do something to their own people who have become our sources. And, of course, it goes in all these directions. But we're really talking about stuff that has real world impact. Now, some of what's made the news, the plans for what we would do in the Taiwan Straits or things like that, a lot of that is the military does a huge amount of planning. Some of this is wargaming. It's just to see, do we have the right kind of forces if this thing were to happen? Some of it is very specific. Which aircraft carrier would we put where if we were doing this? But those kind of things are done against hypotheticals. There's a shelf full of this stuff and says, if the president were to ask tomorrow for us to do this, we can't start thinking about it now. We have to have started thinking about it 3 years ago. So they have a stack of that. And some of what Trump was waving around were those plans. And those are scary. But the ones that really get me and the ones that really go for the Espionage Act, those are the ones that reveal sources and methods. And those are the things that significantly impact our national security.
I think this begs a question, though, and that is, what's the motive behind keeping those documents? And I don't know how this plays out legally, but I've come up with why does Trump want to keep these, right? Why is he holding them so close? And I don't think it's because he's afraid of getting prosecuted, because like I said, that works to his advantage. I think he might have held on to these as, you know, leverage for, you know, other countries that might have damning information on him, like the Steele dossier. Two, he might use them to essentially sell to hostile foreign powers to help him get elected in 2024. Or three, and this is the less evil interpretation, is that they're just souvenirs.
Trophies
for, like, you know, the investment bankers that paid $20,000 to go hunting in the, you know, lions and bring them back. And it's like, oh, it's not really hunting, but whatever.
See him when he goes
you did
to
leave.
Mar-a-Lago.
No, but I was going to say, like, there's a motive here. And I think, and I don't know if that matters legally,
but there's clearly
he's got some intent with these.
He wasn't just like,
I should just take these with me.
I believe that specifically this issue has been bifurcated, right? I believe that we have the Department of Justice that are dealing specifically with, you have this, and you said you didn't have it.
Right.
You conspired with others to keep us from getting it, and we're going to deal with that right now. I think that the bigger question, the one that you're asking, is, well, why did you want to keep these, especially after you've communicated with us now on three separate occasions that we've gotten back everything that you took.
Right.
And by the way, we also have on video, which is the best part. It's like the two dudes that are, it's like, hey, you get the subpoena on Sunday, and it's like Monday morning you get two people walking into the location at Mar-a-Lago where these boxes are, removing things and putting things back, right? So you definitely, through overt acts, you're demonstrating, you know, your efforts to conceal this material and prevent us from retaining it. But you do have agencies, right? Because you have intelligence agencies that have files and have, you know, sources that understand that this president was attempting to, I don't know, engage in certain commercial ventures, you know, beyond our borders with some of these countries. Now, did he actually maintain materials that were somehow favorable to those countries that he can then, you know, engage in negotiations with those countries? You know, Jared made a ton of money, you know, from the Saudis, right? A person who actually, when the presidency began, was in trouble with some of his properties, and when the presidency ended, you know, the man was flush with cash. But I believe that you have those apparatuses within our government that are very interested in this and looking at this. Now, as far as the trial is concerned, the witnesses that are going to be used by the Department of Justice is Pat Cipollone. Pat Cipollone, who is the White House counsel, was the first person to say, hey, look, I know that the whole January 6th thing didn't work out for you, but, you know, you got 14 days to get out, you know, off the premises. You need to return all of these materials, right? And the other thing that I will say is this. Whenever you have an allegation that someone has somehow exploited either a company or an institution, yes, the burden is on the people to prove that it's the individual who intentionally did it. There's like a shadow burden as well. And that shadow burden is you have to also demonstrate that the institution was applying and had, you know, rigid processes in place, and this person just didn't stumble in to an act that exploited the institution.
David Soares on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, June 9th. We'll be back with discussion of another topic on Friday's show after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. The final segment of today's show is also from Friday, June 9th, when Joe Donahue was joined by Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares.
In our final minutes, I would like to talk about other cheery topics, you know, like the debt limit and a borrowing binge, as the New York Times calls it. New York Times calls it a $1 trillion borrowing binge looms after debt limit standoff. The government has avoided default, but the effects of the debt ceiling brinkmanship may still ripple across the economy. So the cure could be the problem.
No. That's so the last time I was on, which was before the X date of June 5th, was that whether this – if this doesn't get resolved, it'll be a global catastrophe. If it does get resolved, there's going to be this grinding pain that results in the U.S. economy because of this brinkmanship. And now we're starting to see what this is as the Treasury Department announces their plans. So as the Treasury Department ran down its cash balances – with all of these emergency measures.
So not catastrophe, just near catastrophe.
Near catastrophe, yeah.
Okay, I mean, well, that makes me feel better. That's good.
That's a great way to describe the 21st century. It's just like the knife edge of near catastrophe.
It's Marvin the Martian at the end of Duck Dodgers, of just holding on to that little piece.
So the Treasury Department ran their cash balances down to near zero, and that's the money they used to pay Social Security recipients, Medicare, Medicaid, veteran salaries, Department of Defense, everything. And again, that's money that Congress authorized them to spend earlier that year. So when the Treasury Department ran their cash balances down to near zero, now they need to make up for all of the spending that they need to do as a matter of course. So what they need to do, because they were forced into this position by congressional Republicans, and it's important to note that this is not a bipartisan issue, this is a manufactured crisis by congressional Republicans, is that they need to raise $1 trillion by September to continue making the payments that, you know, Congress has authorized and promised that they would make.
Isn't that what they do in the fund drive here? Just make trillions of dollars?
And yes.
We just bring Alan over there.
Secretary of Treasury.
That's right.
Alan
it's
Shortalk.
Trillions of dollars that we've made. That's right.
So
we take them 2 weeks.
Yeah. Not to get too much in the weeds here, but when the Treasury Department needs to borrow money to spend on programs it is promised to spend on, they issue government bonds. So the Treasury Department sells a bond to the public. The public loans the government money, cash that the Treasury Department can spend, and then the public can cash in the bond at a later date. But the Treasury Department, because they haven't been able to do that for, you know, the first half of 2023, now needs to do it en masse. So to make those bonds attractive to investors, the Treasury Department is going to have to promise slightly higher interest rates on the bonds they issue. So when the when yields on U.S. government bonds go up, interest rates economy-wide follow suit. So because of this, consumers are going to face higher borrowing costs if they want to take out a mortgage, if they want to buy a new car, on their credit card bills, on student loans. Businesses are going to face higher interest rates on corporate loans and small business loans. That's going to have a contractionary force on U.S. economic growth. Higher interest rates is going to put those regional banks that were in a borderline crisis mode in March in increasingly perilous straits, because as interest rates go up, it jeopardizes their balance sheet, making them more prone to the runs that we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and all of the other ones.
It's depressing, and man. This is really depressing, bro.
This is the point.
This is why we have to be focusing on this stuff, not Trump's legal.
The point is that yesterday the bear market.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
we had the best day the stock market's had.
Yeah, so markets were cheering that, yes, we got over the debt ceiling hump, this is great. Now the rubber hits the road, and you're going to see interest rates creep up slowly. So that means anytime a household or business wants to borrow money, it's going to be more expensive. That depresses economic activity at a very critical point where the U.S. economy is, I don't want to say near catastrophe, but let's say near recession. So congressional Republicans have, again, put the U.S. economy at risk, and now it's legitimately at risk, even though the debt ceiling has been passed. This all could have been avoided if, you know, politicians just agreed to eliminate the debt ceiling or raise it as a matter of course. The brinkmanship that Republicans showed is not just theater. This has real impacts, and we're going to be feeling it over the next couple months. So the fact that it was resolved doesn't mean there won't be negative consequences. They will start rolling out over the next 3 months. So, kind of circling back to what I said with higher interest rate costs, buying a $200 shot of whiskey, you know, on credit, you could argue might not be the best financial choice in an era of higher interest rates.
It was my debit card, not credit.
Okay, there you go. Fiscally responsible Joe.
No, immediately, it was immediately.
It was so bad.
Immediately have impacted the bottom line.
Circling back to where we began with one more dig at Joe. But the thing is, the debt limit crisis, that phase of it is over. But the next round is equally troubling for our economy and for average folks, you know, kitchen table issues, because now you have that ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus who are upset with McCarthy, Speaker McCarthy. So the Republicans were supposed to pass a number of bills this week, the against gas stoves, you know, saying we're going to save your gas stoves and trying to what they call the RAINS Act, which is trying to make it harder for regulatory activity to go on, the regular business of government to go on. And they could not, this is a little wonky, but they could not pass the rule that would allow these bills to go to the House floor. Now, these were never going to be signed into law, but these were what they call messaging bills. But the conservative Republicans, they're so angry with the debt limit vote that 12 of them block passage of the rules that would allow McCarthy to bring bills to the floor. He had to recess the House for the week, send everybody home. Now, why is this a problem? Because it really bodes ominously for the budget bills, the appropriations bills that need to go through the process and get passed. Because in that debt limit agreement, there's a trigger that says if you don't pass them by the end of the year, then there's automatic cuts. And how is McCarthy has a choice now? Is he going to try to align with these ultra-conservatives and bring them back in? Or is he going to start aligning with Democrats?
He's got to align with the Democrats.
This is going to roil the markets again because we got past the debt limit crisis, but now we're on the verge of a new budget crisis.
And so I believe the following, that the Republicans will be doing everything they can to make sure that this hits in early 2024 right. and into the summer. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's always the sitting president who gets blamed for these things no matter what. And
now,
I think that's going to be their strategy, is to
have
their internal fights now. They're going to have their internal fights now, but the saving the economy to them is much less important than a Republican getting elected.
We have less than 5 minutes, but we've been talking mostly about Donald Trump. We've been talking all about Donald Trump, but I would like to just talk about real quick, going back even in looking at the indictment. Joe Biden, the best political avenue here is just keep your mouth shut, right?
Don't say a thing.
Yeah. About that, but keep doing what you're doing. They need to go out and be talking about all the new building with the infrastructure bill. They need to be going out talking about, with all the smoke, you know, all of the work that they're doing on clean energy. They need to be, you know, focusing on those issues. They got a historic legislative wins. Now they have to go out and sell those historic legislative wins. But he cannot. He has not talked about the Justice Department so far.
And he shouldn't.
And he shouldn't.
The subject that you were talking about earlier.
Keep him away from sandbags.
We are going to. He has to lean on Hakeem Jeffries now.
Right.
To engage more with the Republican leadership that wants to actually work and wants to avoid all of these
issues.
We'll
see which direction they go in. And, you know, there are also some really important House races. The House is going to keep trying to force these votes that are difficult for Democrats, and they're messaging that they're never going to, like, the take away your gas stove. The Democrats are not trying to take away your gas stoves. If anybody looked at the details, what Elise Stefanik said in her press conference, it just wasn't true. But it sounds good, right? But I mean, I think the problem with Trump and this indictment, and which has been the problem all along, is there's all this focus on him and his legal problems. At the same time, the country, I mean, we are in the midst of 15 million people, mostly children and elders in nursing homes, getting kicked off Medicaid, and mostly for paperwork errors. 15 million people without health insurance, right? So that's bad for them personally. But if you don't have health insurance, you're still going to get sick. So then there's economic impacts of that, because then you're going to get your health care in the most expensive place for taxpayers, which is you're going to go into the emergency room, which is already not working. This is a chaotic problem that's looming. We have smoke everywhere, right?
You need serious people to get serious issues, bills done.
Right.
And you have an unserious group of people right now.
David Soares on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, June 9th. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are posted online at wamc.org. This has been the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.